I'd like to talk with you a little bit this evening about the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, because so much changed in America when Dr. King was killed. Over the years, I've been involved in investigating other assassinations, including the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But however important a president might be, presidents come and go and politicians come and go, but there never was anyone quite like Martin Luther King, and those people who knew him, who were go to jail with him, know that there probably has never been anyone quite like that before, and probably will never be anyone quite like that again. And that was one of the great losses and changed the whole face of America, and I think changed relations in the course of history for the whole world. And it's important to remember that Dr. King was shot to death on April 4th, 1968, and a year to the day before that, on April 4th, 1967, he took a very powerful and strong public position against the war in Vietnam. 1 year later to the day, he was dead, shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. I'd like to tell you about a woman whose name is not very well known, but who becomes an important figure in contemporary American history. Her name is Grace Walden, and she lived at 418 and a half South Main Street in Memphis, Tennessee. On April 4th, earlier that day, a man named Jim McCraw, a taxi driver in Memphis, went into Jim's Grill, a bar and restaurant on South Main Street, went inside and saw sitting over in the corner a man named Charlie Stevens, a man who had been drunk regularly for some 25 years that the taxi driver knew him, and was sitting there at about noon drinking and drunk then, drinking beer. He saw him, and then he left. Mr. McCraw left, went out to drive his taxi. Just before he left, Stevens staggered over to the counter, bought four quarts of beer, had them put in his paper sack, and went up to the room which he shared with Grace Walden. It wasn't a very important rooming house at that time, but soon the whole world was looking at it because there was a community bathroom which shared a common wall with their little apartment, the little apartment that Grace Walden and Charlie Stevens were in. And from that community bathroom came the shot across Mulberry Street onto the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, the shot later fired that day, which killed Dr. King. A man named Lloyd Jowers owned Jim's Grill, and he went into his place at 4 o'clock that afternoon, and he saw Charlie Stevens was back down in the bar part of the restaurant and was drinking and was drunk, and he sold four more quarts of beer to Charlie Stevens, who went back up to his room and took them up there. The next person besides Grace Walden to see Charlie Stevens was Jim McCraw, the taxi driver. He was driving around town, and the dispatcher said, report back to 418 and a half, pick up Stevens, he wants you to take him to a bar. Well, Stevens was drinking, was drunk, and this was April 4th, and his check came on April 3rd. And while Stevens was drunk almost all the time, you can be certain that on the 4th, 5th, and 6th of the month, the days just after the check arrived, he was really drunk. McCraw went up to the room, knocked on the door, and there was, and he heard a woman's voice, Grace Walden, saying, come on in, the door is open. He opened the door, and there he saw Grace Walden seated in a chair reading a book. Sprawled out on the bed was Charlie Stevens, was drunk. And McCraw said, you're too drunk to take. And Stevens tried to say something but couldn't because he was drunk. McCraw went downstairs, called in on the radio, told the dispatcher, I couldn't pick Stevens up. He was too drunk. Where should I go? And they said, go to Frankie and Johnny's down at the pier. There's a fare waiting there. He started to drive there. About 6 or 7 minutes later, all of the lights, the traffic lights in Memphis, turned red. And the dispatcher called in to all the taxi drivers and said, Dr. King's been shot. Proceed very cautiously. Somebody may be running out there with a gun. There may be police officers. Which means that as you work it back, that he saw Stevens about 5 or 6 or 7 minutes before Dr. King was killed. Grace Walden said, this is what happened after the taxi driver left. He said, Charlie said he had to go to the bathroom. He didn't put it quite that way, but that was the import of his remarks. And he rolled off of the bed onto the floor, got up and went to the bathroom, which was just 5 feet from their apartment, this community bathroom, in the rooming house. And he banged on the door. The killer had been in there since 5 o'clock. He'd locked himself in, and other tenants had tried to get in there, but he didn't answer. Whoever he was, he didn't answer, and remained locked in there. Charlie then staggered down the back stairs into the lot behind the building. And Grace Stevens was there reading her book. Charlie had left the door open, and she heard a shot. She said, I recognized it at once as a shot. Great hunter in Arkansas. My first husband was a hunter. I knew a lot about hunting. I knew it was a shot. She said, so I looked up, and she saw the killer of Dr. King come out of the bathroom and walk down the hallway 5 feet from her. And then Charlie came upstairs a few minutes later, and she said, I heard a shot, and I saw a man come out of there, and he was carrying something in his right hand. She said, his body intervened between me and his right hand. I couldn't see what it was, but it was long and heavy, and he swung it when he walked. And Charlie said, where did he go? And she said, he went down to the front. Charlie said, I better take a look. And she said, no, he's been gone for 5 or 10 minutes. There's no way to find him now. So Charlie went back into the room where he had left his glasses anyway. Remember, when he left, he just expected to go next door to the bathroom. He left his glasses on the bed. At that time, the police arrived and reporters arrived. And they soon discovered that it was Grace Walden who was the only witness in the whole world to the killer of Dr. King. They took her to the police station where she was questioned by the local police and then by the FBI. The FBI took over the investigation at once. And she gave a description of the man. She said, I'm 5'3", and he's either my height or at the most 2 inches taller, the man who came out of the bathroom. 5'5". Very thin, she said. He was in his late 50s or early 60s. He was wearing a hunting jacket, sort of a tan or beige hunting jacket, with a bright checkered or plaid shirt underneath it. You could see it at the neck, because the jacket was open down the front a little way. She gave a very complete description. And they brought in an artist. The FBI brought in an artist. And she described to the artist what the man looked like, and a drawing was made and was sent all over Tennessee and states nearby, and was not a composite based upon what various witnesses saw, but was based solely upon what Grace Walden saw, because she was the only witness in the whole world who saw the killer come out of the bathroom. Then sometime thereafter, James Earl Ray was picked up in London by Scotland Yard based upon information given to them by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And when that happened, the FBI called Grace Walden into the FBI headquarters in Memphis and said, here's an affidavit. We want you to sign the affidavit so we can get Ray back here and prosecute him for the murder of Dr. King. And she said, can I see a picture of the man? And they showed her a picture of James Earl Ray, and she looked at it. She said, that doesn't look anything at all like the man. Nothing at all. How old is that man? And they said that Ray was 39 years old. She said, no, I told you the man who came out of the bathroom was in his late 50s or early 60s. How tall is he? Well, 5'11 or 6 feet. She said, no, I told you he was 5'3 or 5'5. In every single respect, she said, this man looks nothing like the man I saw. And then they started to lean on her. They said, you'll be in a lot of trouble. Oh, thank you. The FBI agent said, you're going to be in a lot of trouble, Mrs. Walden. Unless you sign that affidavit, we want to bring Ray back here and prosecute him. And the whole country wants the killer prosecuted. She said, well, you catch the killer, and I'll sign the statement. But you've got the wrong man. And one of the agents said, I want to tell you this, Mrs. Walden. If you don't sign this statement, your life will be in danger. You will be in a great deal of trouble. And we have the power to see to it that something can happen to you. And she said, well, I can't sign the statement because that's not the man. And then another agent came over, put his arm around her, said, oh, Mrs. Walden, he's just a little upset about this, but we're not bad guys. Listen, there is a reward of $100,000, which has been put up by the Chamber of Commerce of Memphis. You sign this statement. Just sign the statement. And the result will be Ray will be brought back here. He'll be prosecuted, and you will get $100,000. She was a very poor lady, living on welfare. And she said, I'm surprised at you. If I wouldn't lie for no money, do you think I would lie for $100,000? I couldn't do that. And she left. And they said, if you leave without signing the statement, you're going to be in very serious danger. She said, I can't sign a false statement. And so she left. Then they brought in Charlie Stevens because James Earl Ray was over there in England and they had no evidence. The extradition treaty between the United States and England states that the person can be extradited to the United States if evidence is offered to the British court, and then the person can only be prosecuted for the crime for which he's been extradited. Now, Ray had escaped from Missouri Penitentiary a year before. He could have been charged with being a fugitive. He could have been charged with escaping, which is a separate felony. But if he was brought back, and they had evidence for that, if he was brought back under those charges, he could not be prosecuted for the murder of Dr. King, and that's what they wanted. And they had no evidence against him for the murder of Dr. King. So they brought in Charlie Stevens. Poor Charlie, who was drunk, and even outside of the building at the time, who never saw the man, and they said, we'll give you $100,000 if you'll sign the affidavit. He said, well, you ought to talk to Grace. He said, forget about Grace. We want you to sign it. And he signed the affidavit. And that was the only evidence which was available to the British court, and that's why James Earl Ray was brought back to the United States to be tried, based upon that statement. Now, what about Grace Walden? She was a danger. She was a dangerous person to them because if there was to be a trial and she was the only witness in the world, she would have destroyed the case. The next day, two homicide officers came to her room, picked her up, and took her to the John Gaston Hospital, the hospital for the city of Memphis, and they threw her in the mental ward. They gave her a shot of Prolixin, which is disabling sometimes up for 3 weeks. Her face began to twitch. And they took her a few days later together with a number of other elderly people. And they chained them together. This is 1968. I don't mean handcuffed. Chains around their wrists from the mental institution. Chains around their feet. Chains around their waist and chained to each other in a line. The chain gang, and they put him on a bus, and they took him to the courthouse. They took him outside. It was raining. They had him standing there in the rain for about 15 minutes. And then the doctor was ready to see him. And they put Grace Walden in, and the doctor said to her, why are you here? And she said, I think it's because I wouldn't lie about the murder of Dr. King. Well, do you have any fears? She said, I'm afraid of the trial because they said that my life would be in danger if I testified at the trial. And the doctor then went with Grace Walden before the judge. And he said, Judge, this woman has hallucinations. She thinks she was a witness to the murder of Dr. King. And she also has suicidal tendencies anticipating the trial. And the judge signed an order putting her in a mental institution. And they transported her by sheriff's car to the Bolivar Hospital in Bolivar, Tennessee, a mental institution. 10 years later, she was still in that mental institution. 10 years later. And her only crime was that she would not lie about the murder of Dr. King. I heard about it and I went to see her several months ago. And I didn't go into the administration ward. I went directly to where she was. And I asked one of the patients there. Grace Walden was there. And there she was walking down the hallway. And she came and she sat down with me in the hallway on a couple of chairs there. And I didn't tell her that I was the lawyer for James Earl Ray because I didn't want to influence her. I just said, I'm a lawyer looking into the case of the murder of Dr. King. I wonder if you could tell me about it. She said, I can tell you about it, but I can't change my story because I can't lie about what I saw. And if you came here to offer me money or tell me I could be let out of here, I'm not going to lie. I said, no, I don't want you to lie. I just want you to tell me. And I said, can I tape record this? And they said, sure. She said, sure. It'll make it easier for you. So I put on the tape recording, and she described the whole thing that I told you about what she saw that day. At that time, three guards burst into this waiting room area, three male guards and two female guards. The two women guards grabbed Grace and dragged her off and threw her back into a locked-in area. And the three male guards said to me, give us that tape recording at once. This was the first time since Dr. King had been killed and almost 10 years had passed, the first time anybody ever had made a recording of this important witness. And I thought it was important in terms of getting the facts, and also I thought it was important in terms of protecting her to have that record out of the hospital. Because then no matter what they did to her, the record would remain, which means there'd be no sense in doing anything more to her. And one of the guards said, give me that tape. And I said, all right, I'm going to tell you this. My name is Mark Lane. I'm the attorney for James Earl Ray. I'm investigating the murder of Dr. King. And this is part of my work, and you can't have it. And the guard said, I'm going to take that tape. And I said, I want you to understand this. There is no way in the world you will ever get that tape. No way. So you might as well think about more constructive and rewarding tasks. There's no way you'll get this. And I had gone there with an investigator named Renfro Hayes, a local investigator from Memphis, and with a woman who was a friend of his who drove us there in her old car, but the car got us there, 70 miles from Memphis. And I said to her, her name is Sammy Cook, I said to her, let's go. I want to meet with the head of this institution and file a complaint against these three guards for interfering with my interview with Grace Walden. And they said, you're not going anywhere. And then another couple of people joined. And one of them was the switchboard operator. And she said, you know, you're not allowed to talk to Grace Walden. I said, why not? She said, well, we have it on my desk in there where I have the switchboard. She pasted it up on the wall. It's an order from the director of the institution saying that no one can talk to Grace Walden. She can't receive any phone calls. And no one can visit her. I said, does that apply to everybody in the institution? They said, no, just her. I said, I'm going to go file a complaint with him right now. And the guard said, you're not leaving. Well, I don't generally use force or violence. I only do that when it seems necessary. And so I pushed one of the guards out of the way, ran out to the car. Sammy Cook, the woman whose car it was, jumped in the front seat and behind the driver's seat on the wheel, and I jumped it alongside of her. The investigator, Renfro Hayes, was a big, heavy guy, and he sort of moved slowly, and he never quite made it to the car in time. And so we drove off and left him there. I hated to do it, but I thought the tape was important. We got out of there, and we're driving down the highway back toward Memphis, and we'd gone about 2 miles, and there was a flashing red light on a vehicle behind us. It was a police car. And police officers pulled us over to the side of the road, and Sammy Cook in this old car said, this car is in pretty good shape, although it's old. She said, should I try to outrun them? I said, no, don't try to outrun them. And so I said, pull over. So we pulled over, and I had taken the tape out and hid it under the floorboard. I put a blank tape in there, and I said, interview with Grace Walden. I wrote on that. She said, you're going to give them that? I said, no, I'm not even going to give them that. That's just in case worse comes to worse. Anyway, they pulled us over. The two police officers wearing guns with walkie-talkies, and one of them said, you have to go right back to the institution and meet with the director at once. He wants to talk to you, and bring the tape with you. And I said, you work for the state? He said, yes. I said, are you a state highway patrolman? He said, no, I'm in charge of security for the mental institution. Total charge of security there. And I said, would it be safe to say that your area of jurisdiction is confined to the institution? And he said, yes, that's right. And I said, well, goodbye. And we drove off. We got the tape back to Memphis. We made many copies, and we sent them around. So we had that the tape secured. And then I was concerned about poor Renfro Hayes, and we left. It was getting pretty chilly, and he had worn a jacket, but he left the jacket in the car. So he was just there in his shirt sleeves. And we tried to find him. We had difficulty finding him. And he found me 2 days later, though. He was a little bit angry. He said, he decided he was going to go for a walk down the highway and hitch a ride. So that's what he did. It was quite cold. He was just wearing a shirt and it was chilly. And he went down and he hitched a ride and the car stopped and he got in. And the lady driving the car said, don't you think the best thing would be not to run away from the institution? And she drove him right back and turned him in, thinking he was a patient trying to escape some. Anyway, he had a lot of complaints. I went back and saw Grace after that. And I got to know her, and I got to love her. And I was deeply concerned. Well, I loved her all along because of what she did. But then I got to love her as a person. And it was clear that although her mind was clear, she read. That was the way she survived. She read a book every single day. In the 10-year period, she read how many hundreds and hundreds of books, I don't know. There were other people there. They had cats at the institution. And she took care of the cats. And one day, the order came from the director, and they picked up and drowned all the cats, the guards. And that was the only thing that, only other contact she had with people there. Many of the people were really crazy, and it was very hard to have, and there was no effort to help them at all. And it was very hard for her to survive, and she was very often in a room by herself, but she read, and she tried to keep her mind going in the face of, we have the medical records. She was given Thorazine every day. And she was given Prolixin and just one drug after another, all for the purpose of destroying her mind. And it did, of course, have a permanent effect. And if you look into a mental institution, you'll see people there who look crazy. I mean, they look the way we perceive a crazy person to be. And they actually don't look crazy. That's just our perception. They look like people who've been given drugs. Their mouth hangs open, start to walk with a limp. All of these physical reactions which come from the massive drug doses, but most people look in there and say, well, people look crazy. And some of it is, after a long period of time, it's irreversible. And with Grace, some of the physical damage, I think, may be irreversible. In any event, she said, when I saw her two or three more times, she said, could you get me out of here? And I said, I'm going to do everything I can. And I knew that it was a political decision which had been made to put her in there. And while we could bring an action in the court system, it wasn't really a legal statement that we needed as much as a political statement. And so I met in Los Angeles with Reverend James Lawson, a marvelous minister who was, in fact, one of Dr. King's closest workers. He taught the schools of nonviolence for Dr. King. He, in fact, was the chairman of the strategy committee for the sanitation strike in Memphis in 1968. He had invited Dr. King to Memphis. And I met with him. He's now the minister of the largest Methodist church in Los Angeles. I met with him and told him that I met with Grace. And he flew into Memphis, and he organized a meeting of all of the leading religious people in Memphis, the bishop for the Roman Catholic Church, and the leading rabbi, and the black and the white Protestant ministers, and they all met together, and I presented the evidence against the state regarding Grace Walden. And on April 4th, this last year, on the 10th anniversary of the murder of Dr. King, these religious leaders issued a statement demanding that Grace Walden be released from that institution. And this shook the state of Tennessee, because this was the first time there was a group within the establishment of that structure which was making demands on the related to the King case. And so what they did very quickly is they took Grace Walden out of the mental institution and they locked her up in a boarding house. And they had guards in the boarding house. They had the judge sign an order saying it was all right. And they wouldn't tell me where she was. So in a sense, the state could say she's no longer in the state institution. She's not in our custody, but she's being cared for in a halfway house on her own. Made an application for Social Security to pay the guards in the house her money, to pay the guards who are keeping her there. At that time, when all of this was taking place, I thought that someone ought to tell President Carter, who talks about human rights, is deeply concerned about the denial of human rights in every country in the world except the United States. We thought that someone ought to tell him that Memphis, Tennessee is a lot closer than Moscow. And so that message was sent to him, and he said, I can't get involved in these local matters. Remind him, if he could get involved in matters regarding justice in Moscow, he ought to be able to do that someplace a little closer. You think for a moment of how this lady was treated, locked up there for 10 years in this institution, and now even when it was open and out. But the President of the United States would play no part, and his Department of Justice would play no part, and the Attorney General of Tennessee would play no part. And even 10 years later, trying to have an innocent person who was totally sane removed from that institution gives you sort of a clue into the operation of the minds of the ruling circles within the United States. And just, it tells you, about their deep concern for struggling humanity. And that's just one way to examine it. I mean, the fact is, when you see the struggle that is taking place throughout the world, there is not a fascist regime in the world which would not topple tomorrow morning if the United States withdrew its support. There is not one. And there's not a single struggle for national liberation anywhere in the world where the United States has not supported the oppressors. There is not one. But despite that we see today in Nicaragua, these last weeks in Nicaragua, where we, the United States Marine Corps, installed Somoza 4 decades ago, see the struggles taking place now. And we see in Iran where the United States, with the Central Intelligence Agency, installed the Shah in order to develop our relationship with the oil interests there. But even there, the struggles are taking place. So the same morality which we see oppressing the people within the United States is oppressing people throughout the world, but the struggle takes place not only in the United States, but the struggle against that same enemy takes place all throughout the world, wherever there are people struggling for liberation, as there were now in this case with the religious people finally coming together in Memphis. And so they placed her in this rooming house, and I found out where she was. And I went over to see her. There were the guards there, and I walked in. And I said, Grace, when was the last time you had dinner out in a restaurant? And she said, oh, maybe 11 years ago. I said, I'd like to take you out to dinner now, all right? And she said, okay. And the guard said, no, she can't leave. And I said, I've already talked to the judge, Judge Evans, charge of the probate court. He said I could have dinner with Grace. So we're leaving now. And we walked out to go to dinner. Memphis, and there was a car waiting for us out there, and we drove away, and the people looked out of the window, wrote down the license plate number, and we went 2 blocks and changed into another car which was waiting for us. And we drove to the airport in Memphis, Tennessee. And I didn't make any reservations in advance because I didn't want a record of that. And I started running around to the airlines and said, who's flying to Los Angeles? Because I was living there then, working with Don Freed on a film about the assassination of Dr. King. And I was living out in L.A. And I went to various airlines and who's flying? They said, well, there's a plane leaving in 15 minutes for Dallas. You can switch there for planes to Los Angeles. And that was the the way to leave. It struck me at that point, Memphis, Dallas, Los Angeles, the three major assassination capitals of the United States. And we're going to touch down at all of them. So we went there, and I bought two tickets, and they said, well, this plane, which is leaving, is fully booked. And in fact, it's coming in filled, and 14 people are leaving, but there are four ahead of you, and there's another plane which is connecting with it with 10 people going on, so there aren't going to be any seats. The next plane was not to leave for 3 hours, and I knew if we were gone for 3 hours, they would know it wasn't dinner, and they would be out there by then. We were just sitting there waiting, hoping that two people wouldn't show up, or something would go wrong, or actually something would go right in this case. And we waited. At that point, the CBS television crew somehow had heard about this, and they came out there, and they said they're going to film Grace. And I said, well, okay, if we get on the plane, film her. And he said, no, we have to film her now, and we're going to rush it back, and it'll be on the 10 o'clock news. And so you'll be gone by then. I said, that's great, because if we're on this plane, we'll be gone. I don't care what's on the news here. But if we can't get on the plane, we'll still be here at 11:30, which is when the next plane leaves. And if it's on the 10 o'clock news, the police and the FBI will come and take her back. And he said, well, I'm sorry, but, you know, we just have to present the news. And I said, well, you can't. I'm not going to let you film her now until we know we're going to get on the plane. And he said, well, I mean, you can't stop me, can you? I said, yes, I'm going to break your camera. Well, that's a, he said, this is a $12,000 camera, and it's checked out to me. I said, this woman's been in an institution for 10 years. Who cares about a $12,000 camera? I said, if you try to film, I'm going to break it. He said, well, let's work out a compromise. And I said, that's fine. I'm always willing to do that. What's your suggestion? He said, well, if she gets on the plane, let me come on the plane and film her there. I said, that's great. That's fine. At that point, the plane was almost ready to go, and the woman behind the counter called us over and said, that other plane with the 10 passengers connecting with this one has been delayed, and therefore there are seats so you two can get on now. So, we got on the plane and sat down, and the TV crew came on. All the times I've flown on planes, I've never seen a television crew on a plane. And here was Grace looking really terrible. I mean, 10 years of misuse by the state of Tennessee. Her hair was a mess, and she had no teeth at all, and they never gave her any false teeth. She had absolutely no teeth at all. And she had been eating terrible food and been given these drugs and wearing an old dress. She really looked terrible. And here was this television crew filming her. And the pilot came out, and the co-pilot came out. All the stewardesses came over and said, who is she? What's that all about? Well, I didn't want to tell them what the facts were because I was afraid that some patriotic Tennessee citizen might run out and grab a hold of the wheel and call for the FBI and not let the plane leave. So I said, well, her name is Grace Daniels. She's the heir to the Jack Daniels fortune. At that point, Grace turned around and said, yes, and when we're airborne, all the drinks are on me. And everybody cheered, and we took off, and we landed in Dallas, and then from Dallas I called Don Freed and said, it's safe to tell you now we're on the way back, and you better have a couple of people at the airport because probably by now the FBI knows, and if anything happens, we'd like to have some friends out there. So from the time we left Dallas until the time we got to L.A., which was a couple of hours, Don had made some phone calls, and there were about, Reverend Lawson was there, there were about 200 people at the airport, and a crowd of people from all over, the whole Los Angeles and area, Beverly Hills and Orange County, just about 200 people, about a dozen ministers were there, and a lot of other people, and some people who in the past had provided some kind of physical support, some really big people were standing around also, and a couple of people who we thought were FBI agents, but they were sort of way in the background and just observing from a distance, and there were two TV crews there. This was Grace Walden's first television interview. As she got off the plane, And we weren't expecting, I thought the Dom would have a few people there, but I didn't expect this. And everybody applauded and sang when she got off the plane, and the cameras moved quickly in on her, and I didn't know how she could handle this after 10 years. But she was marvelous, and the reporter said to her, "What do you think of Memphis, Tennessee now?" And she said, "Oh, it's just a smug little river town. You can't blame them." And what about the murder of Dr. King? She said, "Well, I saw who did it, and they have the wrong man. And they've known they've had the wrong man for 10 years. And she said, "Now that I'm out, I'm going to do everything I can to try to get that man freed, because he didn't do it, and they know he didn't do it." So it was a very good, strong statement. That was on television in Los Angeles. And so she was out, and she's out now. And there are still problems with her. I mean, you know, 10 years of that massive drug abuse program. And but she's visited a couple of leading psychiatrists in Los Angeles who say that there is mentally nothing wrong with her, and there never was, that her mind is clear. But during that 10, she has almost no memories at all during that 10-year period. She remembers things fairly clearly prior to the 10 years and everything since the time that she's been out. She's been staying with me, with my family now. She remembers things since that time, but she has almost no memory during that entire 10-year period. She remembers the cats all being killed and one or two other horrible things like that, but basically cannot remember what took place. So they rob 10 years from her and from her mind. But she really is one of the true heroes of this terrible period, because she wouldn't lie. And I think that when they chose this place from which the shot was fired to kill Dr. King, was chosen for a lot of reasons. And I think one of them was because poor people live there, really poor people, and people who could be pushed around, people who had tuberculosis, people who drank too much, alcoholics living there. And I think the feeling was, if anybody sees anything, no one will pay any attention to these people. They're not bank presidents or important, impressive people in society. The people we've grown to respect, attorney general like, and lawyers like Richard Nixon and John Mitchell and Ehrlichman and Haldeman, all those people who we know would never lie, people like that. Those important people weren't living there. Just working class people and people who had failed in a very acquisitive society. And I'm sure that part of the thinking of choosing that place as the place in which the shot would be fired to kill Dr. King is, we can manipulate those people. They have no money, they have no power, they're weak, and we'll tell them what to do and they'll do it, and if they don't, we'll offer them some money, and if they don't take that, we'll threaten them, they'll have to do it. That was the analysis. But it didn't work, because there's always one person. In this case, it was Grace Walton. And so it didn't work. So their whole strategy went down the drain at that point. I'd like to talk with you about what else was taking place to lead up to the murder of Dr. King. J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, had issued an order not too long before then to the special agent in charge of the destroyed King Squad, a special group which they had established in the Atlanta office of the FBI called the Destroy King Squad. Now, we have all the documents and all the papers now, finally, all these years later for the first time. And the order was, send a letter to King telling him to commit suicide. And that letter was sent. And it was to be sent from a place in the Deep South. That was Hoover's special order, that an agent was to have the letter typed. They destroyed the typewriter after they prepared the letter. And the agent went down to Tampa, Florida, carrying this letter inside of another envelope, took a taxi from the Tampa, Florida airport into town, put on his gloves, took the inner envelope out of the outer envelope so he would not leave fingerprints, and mailed the letter and flew back to Washington, D.C. And what was the strategy? When Dr. King saw this letter, he would not know that it came from the FBI. He would think it came from some racist deep in the South. Actually, it was coming from a racist deep in Washington, D.C., and deep in the administration. But this was part of the contrived government program to tear black and white Americans apart, to make Dr. King believe it was a white racist in the South, when in fact it was a government order. It had no geographic identity. It came from Washington, D.C. And Dr. King got that letter, and he opened it, and he read it. And it said, it was 34 days before he was to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway. And it said, you have 34 days to kill yourself. Otherwise, you will be exposed internationally as a sexual pervert. We have tapes and photographs and films, which had been, in fact, developed, manufactured in the FBI laboratory. It's proof. And Dr. King saw it, and he called in a few people who he knew, Andy Young and a few others, and showed him the letter and said it had to come from J. Edgar Hoover. Who else would have sent such a crazy letter? And he said, now we have to understand this. In the past, we knew that the Bureau was going to give us no protection in the struggles in the South or in the North. But now we have to know something else. Dr. King said, Hoover wants me dead. He wants me dead. And so the ball game has changed. We have to be very careful. Very careful from now on. So when Dr. King spoke that last night and made the speech which the press has said was not only prophetic, but was somehow mystically inspired, divinely inspired, where he said, we as a people will get to the promised land, but I may not get there with you, but I've been to the mountaintop, when he made that speech. And he walked off the stage saying, but I tell you this, I am not fearing any man. And he walked off the stage. The press made it seem as if somehow divinely he had been inspired. He was reacting to what he knew was Hoover's program to kill him. And that was the man that he said he was not fearing, because he had done work that had to be done while he was on the earth. But Hoover did more. Dr. King was under FBI surveillance 24 hours a day, year after year after year after year. Even when he went to Oslo, Norway, FBI agents were on the plane with him. And when he landed to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, the FBI had already bugged all of the hotel rooms in Oslo where he and his family and his friends and associates stayed, and they also tapped all of the phones that they would use in the hotel. And when he came back to the United States, every hotel, every motel, his church, his home, his office, everyone was bugged by the FBI. Sometimes they would have as many as 25 different FBI agents provide surveillance of Dr. King on a 24-hour-a-day basis, while 15 others monitored him electronically. As many, an army of 40 FBI agents just looking at Dr. King. 1 hour before he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee, Hoover gave the order, withdraw all surveillance. 1 hour. 25 agents disappeared, and the electronic surveillance was pulled off 1 hour before. That left just the local police in Memphis to provide protection. And there was a police officer named Ed Reddit. And what had happened is that about a week before then, on March 28th, Dr. King had been asked to go to Memphis and lead a nonviolent march on behalf of the sanitation workers. Now, King was moving in a massive campaign of Poor People's March on Washington, D.C. for April. And the whole idea was to get hundreds of people, thousands of people, maybe tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands eventually, of a rainbow of Americans coming to all poor people, the whites from Appalachian, blacks and brown and yellow and red from all over America, all poor people, and to set up tents right there in Washington, D.C., right in front of the three House of Representative office buildings and right in front of the two United States Senate's office buildings, and remain there until something was done to bring about a change in the economic structure, which required so many people to be poor, so many people to go without dinner at night, go to bed hungry at night, and required what we see in the press today, that the illiteracy rate is rising in the United States, while illiteracy has been abolished in what we refer to as underdeveloping countries throughout the world. It's growing within the United States. And Dr. King had moved on from the struggle of just civil rights and was talking about economic justice and bringing about some sound structural changes in the economic structure of the United States. That's what he was doing when he was killed. And in the middle of all of this, he was invited to go to Memphis and lead a nonviolent march on behalf of the sanitation workers. And some of his aides said, oh, don't go. Keep your eye on the national program. Don't be distracted for a few days in Memphis. And he reminded them of the necessity of standing with the least of these, the most oppressed of these, and he flew off. Remember that campaign in Memphis? It was not for higher wages. It was for the dignity of labor. Those black sanitation workers marched with signs which didn't ask for higher wages. Didn't ask for better conditions. The sign said, I am a man. That was the campaign, and it was impossible for Dr. King to refuse that request. He went there, and they marched. And Reverend Lawson organized and led that march. And this is what he told me. As they marched down, a group of young black people, there was a group there called the Invaders, a black militant youth group, wore black jackets, something like the Black Panther Party. A group of young black people started smashing windows and hurling insults at Dr. King. And Reverend Lawson looked up and said, those guys are dressed like the Invaders, but they're not the Invaders. Turns out they were working for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And they turned a nonviolent march into a violent demonstration. And when the windows were being broken, things were being stolen from the stores in the black community, Reverend Lawson said to Dr. King, let's turn the march around. Dr. King said, I'm not afraid. And Lawson looked up ahead and he saw on the next block the police were there with their weapons. And people were looking out of windows. And that was the next block. And he had the feeling that, he said, the police weren't coming in and stopping the looting. They were taking no action at all. And he had the feeling that they wanted Dr. King to walk one more block. And who knows what would have happened there. And if Dr. King was killed in a struggle one more block later, it always could have been said this young black militant group had started the riot and Dr. King was killed as a result of the riot, which the young black activists had started. Reverend Lawson said, no, it's not our march anymore. Let's turn it around. And Dr. King was reluctant, but a group of people pushed him in a car, and they drove him to the Holiday Inn Rivermont, which is a large building outside of the downtown area, which provides excellent security. No buildings anywhere near it, and you go into a central entrance, and when you're in there, you go to your room, and there's no way anyone can shoot you from the outside. And he went there, taken there. That same day, Hoover, we now have the memo, Hoover ordered the special agent in charge of the Memphis office of the FBI to make sure that King came back to Memphis and that he stayed in the Lorraine Motel because he had reservations for the Holiday Inn Rivermont. What is there about the Lorraine Motel? It's built like a shooting gallery. There's no way to provide any security because there's no central entrance. You go up to the balcony, and you walk right down on that long balcony until you get to your room, and across the street there are bushes and trees and a series of buildings, including that rooming house where Grace Walden stayed, with windows looking out over the area. And half a block away, there's a fire station, which overlooks the area. Hoover's memo to Robert Jensen, the special agent in charge of the FBI in Memphis, said, send out a statement to our friends in the news media at the two newspapers in Memphis and the radio and television stations. Embarrass King into checking into the Lorraine Motel. Make sure he does not stay at the Holiday Inn Rivermont. And the FBI prepared a statement which it said at the bottom, not to be attributed to the Bureau. And they gave it to their friends in the news media in Memphis. The Free Press in Memphis. That's how it functioned then. That's how it functions now. And this, they even wrote the headline. Headline says, do as I say, says King, not as I do. And then the statement went on to say, King is coming back here to Memphis, and he's telling all of the Negroes, boycott white-owned establishments. But what is he doing himself? He's staying in the posh, white-owned Holiday Inn Rivermont. Why didn't he stay in the Lorraine Motel, owned by Negroes, a perfectly respectable place? And that was published all over Memphis. And some of Dr. King's aides, Andy Young particularly, and others said, it'll be embarrassing if he stays at the Holiday Inn. And they moved his reservations to the Lorraine Motel. And he was on that balcony when he was shot to death. Well, people around Dr. King asked that there be police protection. And so they had assigned, in the past, 14 police officers. Now there were death threats, and they reduced the squad to two police officers. Ed Reddit, a black officer, who was in charge of the operation, and another man named Patrolman Richmond. They were the only two. And this was the plan they worked out. Reddit said, we'll stay over here in the fire station, right across the street. If anything happens, he said to Richmond, you run in with your walkie-talkie. There are six vehicles on the perimeter, each with two officers in them. Seal off the area. I'll run down to South Main Street and see if I see anything happening there. Well, if that plan had been in effect, we wouldn't be talking 10 years later about wondering who killed Dr. King. What happened was whoever killed Dr. King ran out in the street and put his rifle down there on South Main Street, and Ed Reddit would have been there with his pistol drawn and would have been able to stop the killer at that point. Hours before, a man named Frank Holloman, the only man ever to be the director of fire and police in Memphis at the same time, had ordered the only two black firemen at Fire Station 2 to be dispersed to other fire stations many miles away. The only two black firemen there, both of whom were militant supporters of Dr. King. They were sent to locations where they were surplus employees, had nothing to do, and yet they couldn't even get the engines out without them at Fire Station 2. If there had been a fire there, they could not have taken it out because one company required five, the other company required four. They were in two separate companies, and they could not even get the engines out that day. It was just a panic to get them out of there. And now, 2 hours before Dr. King was killed, Holloman sent word to Ed Reddit, to the chief of domestic intelligence for the Memphis Police Department, I want Reddit in my office at once. So Reddit was taken to his office. Reddit said, I'm supposed to be in charge of security. He said, well, I know that, but this man here is from the United States Secret Service. He says there's a death threat out against you. So I'm sending you home under police control. And you're to remain home. He said, well, look, I mean, he's going to be leaving there soon, coming out of that balcony. He's going to Billy Kyle's house, a black minister in Memphis. Let me make sure he just gets there. Then I'll feel safe. He'll be in the community. He'll be okay. The answer was, no, I'm sending you home. And he said, well, I don't want to be home. I mean, if there really is a death threat against me, and I don't know how that could be, but if there's a death threat against me, I don't want to be with my family, or somebody could throw a bomb in and kill us all. I'd rather be out on the street and take my chances. He said, well, it's not what you want. I'm ordering you home. They sent him home with two police officers. They're sitting there in the car in front of his house. And he said, you know, would you just let me go back there to make sure the King gets out of there okay? And the answer was no. He said, well, all right, where are you guys going to be staked out? And the officer in charge said, no, we're going into the house with you. He said, well, if you're providing protection for me, you have to be out on the street staking out the house. The answer was, no, we're going to be watching you. So then he knew it was the idea was to keep him in the house, not to protect him, to keep him there. They had the radio on playing music in the background. They interrupted the program to announce at that moment that Dr. King had just been shot. That left only one police officer, Richmond, stationary police officer, and six patrol cars. Now we get to the official statement of the Memphis District Attorney General, Phil Connally. This is his explanation. I'm quoting him now. At 5 minutes to six, I'll add parenthetically, which was 6 minutes before Dr. King was killed. At 5 minutes to six, he said, all of the police cars, all of the men in the police cars, drove to the fire station to use the bathroom facilities. All 12 men in all six police cars. So that's why there was no perimeter at the time Dr. King was killed. He said, but there's nothing surprising about that. They've been out in those cars since 7:45 in the morning, and at 5 minutes to six, they all had to go to the bathroom at the same time. Now, that's a well-trained police force. And they were there in the urinal when the shot was fired, and there was Patrolman Richmond with his walkie-talkie, prepared to seal off the area, but there was no one to talk to. They're all in the bathroom.
When you put this all together, what do you discover? You find out that Mr. Hoover wanted Dr. King dead. He said it. Find out that the FBI surveillance of Dr. King ended just before he was killed. And then the local police and fire department was raided so that the witnesses were removed, the black witnesses, and so security was removed. Now, the last thing is to find out who Frank Holloman is, who did this. He had just arrived on the scene just a couple of weeks before and became the director of fire and police. He was responsible for stripping away the witnesses and responsible for stripping away the security. Who was he? He had just retired after 25 years as a chief executive in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. His last job for 8 years had been as chief inspector in charge of J. Edgar Hoover's office, personal office, person in charge of that office. When you put it all together, it certainly looks to me as if the FBI has to be considered to be the prime suspects in the murder. Now you add to that the statement. You add to that the statement from Arthur Murtaugh, who had been with the FBI for 20 years and 9 months, a senior member of the group of the intelligence squad in Memphis called the Destroy King Squad. An interview which I had with him not too long ago. This is what he told me. He said, our job, he said, was to destroy Martin Luther King and everyone around him. He said, even after King was killed, we sent a memo up to Hoover and said, should we disband now? He's dead. And Hoover's answer was, no, now destroy his memory because the Congress may make his birthday a national holiday. Destroy his memory. Brief every member of Congress. Let them know what a scoundrel he was. And so the squad went on. Then Andy Young decided to run for Congress. And Murtaugh was ordered to break into his informants working the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, to have them break into the office of the SCLC and steal letterheads of the SCLC stationery and steal samples of Andy Young's handwriting. The FBI laboratory was going to write love letters signed by Andy Young to the wife of every minister in Atlanta for the purpose of disrupting the campaign. Now, why Hoover would imagine that Andy Young would have done that on the official stationery of the SCLC is a little difficult to understand, but it would have caused some mischief, and Murtaugh refused to do it, but another agent did it, and those letters were sent out. This is what Murtaugh told me. I said, do you remember April 4th? He said, oh, yes, I was on the 9th floor of the federal building in Atlanta. We were checking out that day. It's a block-long building with our salmon-colored cards. And we were checking out, and with me, he said, was the second in charge of the Destroy King Squad, the assistant supervisor of the Destroy King Squad. And as we were checking out, the radio announced that Dr. King had been shot. And he said, this man, my supervisor, said, I hope the son of a bitch dies. The FBI. A few minutes later, they announced that Dr. King had died. Murtaugh, an FBI agent loyal to the Bureau for 20 years and 9 months, said, when it was announced on the radio that Dr. King had died, this man, this high official in the FBI Destroy King Squad, literally left his feet in a leap for joy. The code name which the FBI had assigned to Dr. King was Zorro. Zorro was coming here, Zorro was going there. And Mr. Murtaugh said, this official of the FBI left his feet in a leap for joy, slapped his hands together, and said, we got Zorro. Zorro's dead. Later, as 50 American cities went up in flames, as blacks throughout the country were saying to the white power structure, we'd like some information about the murder of Dr. King, and then it was 100 cities. The Attorney General of the United States looked out of his window, the Department of Justice building in Washington, and couldn't even see the Capitol because of the smoke inundating the city. And he realized something had to be done. There was, he said, to be a full investigation of the murder. And so he called J. Edgar Hoover and asked him to look into it. Hoover called the special agent in charge of the Atlanta office of the FBI and gave him full authority to conduct the investigation. And he turned it over to the Destroy King Squad. And those who celebrated Dr. King's murder conducted the only federal investigation into that assassination. And despite this, the American news media supports the official version, just as they support the official version of the murder of President Kennedy. New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, the L.A. Times, CBS, NBC, ABC. There's not a single portion of the American news media which has not editorially endorsed the Warren Commission report. And what does the Gallup poll taken last January show? 82% of the American people say they think the Warren report's a lie and are convinced it was a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy. And about the same number are convinced that it was a conspiracy to kill Dr. Martin Luther King. And yet the news media goes on as if the American people don't exist, as if those opinions don't exist, and continues to offer additional support for their theory and the government's theory of the lone assassin involved. When James Earl Ray testified recently before the Congress, he began by revealing something which was just not known anywhere in America. And that is that when Dr. King was shot, we now have all of the FBI documents proving this. When Dr. King was shot, the first man on the scene who ran up to the balcony and started giving him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, the worst thing you can do when the man's bleeding to death, started moving him around, was a man named Merrill McCullough, dressed like a Black Panther, like an invader, a Black Panther. He was the man who led the riot on March 28th, which required Dr. King to come back to the city. You've all seen that picture of everybody pointing from the balcony up there, Andy Young and Jesse Jackson and the others. You look at that picture, Ralph Abernathy, you look at that picture closely, there's someone kneeling over Dr. King. He's not pointing. He's kneeling over Dr. King. That's Merrill McCullough. That's the man in that world-famous picture published in the New York Times and newspapers all around the world, never identifying that man. Merrill McCullough, his name is. The first person to reach Dr. King. He's not pointing. I'll tell you why. Because he pointed originally. He said it's from that window. And then the rest of them took up the point. And then he was no longer pointing. Who is he? Everybody, Ralph Abernathy, when I saw him in Washington, I showed him a picture. I said, who is that? He said, well, I don't know who that is. Jesse Jackson didn't know. Andy Young didn't know who that man was on the balcony with him. He's a full-time Memphis police employee assigned to infiltrate the invaders. And according to documents we now have for the first time, at the same time, a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And he was the first person to reach Dr. King, and he established the point of origin of the bullet. And 10 years later, that was not known until we got the documents, and James Earl Ray said that, and not one newspaper in America printed it. Not one newspaper in the entire country printed it. And so the struggle, of course, for truth and morality still goes on, and it's a struggle which I can't report that we have won, or that there are signs that we are on the verge of winning, but the struggle goes on. I'd like to tell you about the last day. I know when Don Fried came here, he was very happy to come here and very excited about coming here, but heartbroken that he was leaving on the last day of James Earl Ray's testimony. And so I'll bring you up to date on what he didn't see, but what happened just after he left Washington. James had been attacked regularly by the members of the Select Committee. And they asked him, where were you on March 27th? Where were you? What hotel did you stay at? Where did you drive from here to... And I try to point out to the members of the committee that if I had asked any of them where they were 1 week ago for dinner, they probably would have a great difficulty trying to...